and welcome to Addicted to Murder. This is Courtney, licensed professional counselor with over a decade of experience.
And this is Trisha, and it is way too warm outside to have a tosset right now.
A tosset?
It's an igloo tunnel.
Oh, yeah, it would probably melt.
I noticed that you're wearing a tank top.
I am.
And yesterday it was like 30 degrees outside. Oregon's weird.
It is weird. Yesterday I went to work in like my winter coat and left work in a t-shirt. Right. So
yeah. I put on a long sleeve thin shirt this morning and then changed into a t-shirt once I realized how warm it really was outside. So
yep. It's still only fake spring though, and by next weekend it's gonna be like 40 degrees again, I think.
The 19th, the equinox, officially spring begins.
Right. And that doesn't mean that Oregon weather knows that.
No, I know. We still get snow.
Sometimes.
I mean, the only snow I've seen this year really was the beginning of March.
That's true.
For me. I mean, you're higher up, but.
We didn't get that much. We just got like a couple days of like, it was there, but melted by like 2 p.m.
Yeah.
Kind of snow.
Yeah. Well, we're back, and I'm sorry that we took a week off in between the episodes on the same case. We've never done that before, but I wasn't feeling well last weekend, and Courtney had a bunch of shit due, so that's how it happened.
Yep.
I got shamed at work about it, but
we're on top of it.
I also got made fun of because I couldn't say the name of that damn book at work.
Drop Dead Dangerous.
Not gorgeous. Dangerous.
Yes.
I've practiced it. Drop Dead Dangerous is the book that we're using.
Yes, it is. Good job.
Now I forgot who the author was.
It's Ryan Green.
Is that right?
I think so.
Okay. It'll be in the show notes.
We've used several of his books.
Yeah.
He's prolific.
It's funny. You can tell when British or when writers are British.
Because of how they spell certain things.
Yeah, like offense, mm-hmm. You know, with a C-E.
Yep.
Instead of an S-E.
Or like favorite with a U.
Yeah. The boot of the car,
mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. So I don't often know until I'm like reading, like, oh, these aren't American authors.
Yes.
These be British or European or whatever.
Sure.
So anyhow, we are back with the Casanova Killer, Paul John Knowles.
Yep.
Part two. And before we dive into it, Courtney has a question.
I do have a question. So, Trisha, would you rather live in a world where there are no problems or live in the real world but have magical powers?
Well, no problems.
Yeah.
That would definitely help with my anxiety. Magical powers would be cool, though.
That's right.
But
you could solve problems using your magical powers.
But then I always think about like those genies and the three wishes and how that just makes more problems.
You fix something.
It's like a ripple effect, the butterfly effect.
That's true.
It's a good movie. Did you ever see it?
Yes.
With Ashton Kutcher?
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting movie. Kind of depressing movie.
Well, yeah.
But what about you?
You know, I usually say magical powers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think also if there are no problems at all, then there's no, like, character development. There's no innovation. There's, like, everything is just working fine. And so no one has to improve or do anything different.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had magical powers, I could fix some problems.
Yeah. I mean, there's pluses and minuses for both.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was perfect in character, then I guess I wouldn't care if I didn't develop it.
But you might care if other people never develop.
Because there wouldn't be a problem.
Mm. Or we'd all be boring. It would just be a boring world.
That's true. Could be boring. There's worse things than being bored.
That's true.
I've discovered lately.
Yes.
All right. Well, according to that, would you rather? How about you give us a recap?
Okay. So 2 weeks ago, we met Paul, who was born into a poor and neglectful family. He fell into a life of petty crime at an early age, often stealing in order to feed himself and his siblings. He didn't really attend school, and he ran away from home several times. So when he was 15, he was sent to the notorious Florida School for Boys, where he experienced 3 years of horrific physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. When he was released on his 18th birthday, he began traveling around, stealing cars and committing burglaries to get by. He was in and out of jail for his crimes, including for kidnapping a police officer and for escaping from jail more than once. And during one of these stints in jail, however, he met a girl, kind of.
Yeah. Well, so like all good love stories, this one starts as a prison romance. Insert sarcasm here. The pen pal program that Paul was a part of linked him up with Angela Kovic. And for the first time, Paul found a woman he could talk to as a partner and not as a, like, object. I guess you could say he let his guard down a bit and entertained the meaning of what real love was. Not what he had been used to. Not one with physical punishments and desertion and stuff like that, but something real. Almost a desertion.
That's how it's spelled.
I know. Did I put that word in? This is my word?
That's your word.
Sometimes I get flowy when I write. So anyhow, not what he had been used to, not one with physical punishments and desertion, but something that was real. And it was also a win for the guards, his feelings for Angela, because they now had something that he didn't want taken from them, and so he behaved. He did lie to Angela, kind of played down his crimes, but, you know, who wouldn't in his situation? Angela was married to an older man, but the marriage was not in a good place. Some sources I've read said they were already divorced. The book said she was still married. But anyhow, this may be one of the reasons that John was an attractive option for Angela, and he was also, let's not forget, a good-looking bad boy. So the two of them fell for each other pretty intensely. They had written hundreds of letters to each other, and one day she actually came and visited him. She was smitten. He was in love for the first time, and he proposed then and there in the prison, and she said yes. But there was a problem. John was sentenced to prison for about 10 years. Angela got him a smooth-talking attorney who worked his magic and got him released. Unfortunately, when it actually happened, Angela panicked. I think she was safe in her dream world, and it hit her when it became a reality. What are your thoughts, Courtney?
So I want to talk about Paul first. You know, all that Paul knew of other people in his life prior to this was cruelty and mistreatment or being completely ignored. And so when he met Angela, he was vulnerable and primed to basically latch onto the feeling of being loved and idolizing the woman who gave it to him. Love was a fantasy for him. And similarly, though, Angela was in a bad marriage and looking for an escape. So her love with Paul was also a fantasy. And fantasies rarely hold up when exposed to the light of day.
Yeah. Well, when he was released, he went to San Francisco to find Angela. And Angela was a mess. She couldn't talk to her friends because they would have told her she'd done a crazy thing, you know, getting a man released from prison so she could marry him. So what she did instead was she went to her psychic, and that psychic told her that it was bad. It was very bad. The psychic said that there was a tall, dangerous man coming into her life, and she honed in on dangerous. And when Paul arrived at her house, he had a bouquet of flowers in his hands, hoping that...
the sweet gesture of like, here I am with these flowers.
And that they would have a big embrace and blah, blah, blah. But instead of that, she wouldn't even let him inside the house. She told him it was over, the whole thing. And she closed the door on his face. And it really hurt Paul. Oh, yeah. And like I said, she was still married. So eventually they worked stuff out, but then eventually she'd get divorced. But anyways, Paul John Knowles would no longer be in her life. So, Courtney, what a blow. What do you think this did to Paul?
I think that this rejection and heartbreak was really the final breaking point for Paul. Any little sliver of hope that was left after his stay at the Florida School for Boys, that he could ever be loved or that, you know, there were good, caring people in the world, was pretty much destroyed.
Well, to say that Paul took this badly would be an understatement. He thought he had finally found someone to love, rescue, and help him be a good man. Maybe, you know, he would grow a conscience. I don't know. Well, that sure shit wasn't going to happen now. He had been scorned. He was pissed. He was free. And he was very dangerous. Drop dead dangerous.
Yes.
Okay, so at this point in his story, there is less evidence proving what we're going to go over. Most of what we say kind of comes from Paul himself. And, you know, they lie, but this is just what we're going to go by. So at the time, there wasn't, you know, back then in the 70s or 60s, 70s, there wasn't the same way to track his whereabouts. And he wandered a bit. And we'll see this a lot. And according to him, after this rejection, he was so angry that he committed his first murder. Well, he actually claimed to have killed 3 people that same night he was rejected in San Francisco. The facts show that several murders in San Francisco occurred around this time, but none of them have been confirmed to be Paul. So it's hearsay.
Right.
At this point. So after this, though, he went back to Florida. Sorry, I missed my spot. He went back to Florida where he was continuing to wallow in his despair. He felt unworthy of love. And who could blame him with the track record he had? So one evening he was in a bar and, he was there for 12 hours and consuming lots of alcohol and getting very drunk. Paul lost control when the bartender tried to get him to settle up his tab and to leave. And he sprung on the man and stabbed him in the ribs with a knife he had. He was immediately horrified by what he had done and he tried to stop the bleeding. He was also covered with blood and the others at the bar, were not realizing that he was trying to help. So they were pulling him off and they punched him a few times to knock him down and they called the police and an ambulance. And Paul just sat there and he was kind of in a daze. Courtney, do you think this was an accident? Like in the sense he wasn't really trying to hurt anyone, maybe like a impulse from PTSD perhaps, I don't know, as he would later claim?
Yeah, so I don't know that I would call it an accident, but I do believe it was impulsive and unplanned. Paul was usually pretty careful when he was committing his crimes, picking locks instead of using force and not really seeking out violence. I doubt that he was thinking about killing this bartender when he walked over. So it seems more likely that he was just very intoxicated, brooding about his broken heart and letting his anger build up. And he just reacted impulsively to feeling threatened.
Yeah, that's kind of what it seemed like, too. So he was arrested. And as per usual, he didn't put up a fight. In fact, he seemed really solemn that they actually... The cops kind of were worried about him, so they actually called in a doctor to make sure he was okay because he was acting so weird. The guy he stabbed, the bartender, did not die. But Paul John Knowles went to trial, and at this trial, he didn't even try to defend himself. He was found guilty, and what prevented him from life, like a life sentence, was that it had not been premeditated, or that's what they decided. The time, though, was added to his new sentence because he was out on parole for the past crimes that, you know, Angela's lawyer got her out for. I couldn't figure out the complete amount of the sentence, but the book made it sound like he may never be released after the crimes put together. Anyhow, this is not how his story is going to play out. He was in his jail cell and got frustrated and kicked at the door hard. Yeah, so it just popped open. And he ran, grabbed what he could, ducked and hid from the guards on his shift, and exited the prison. Free again. Courtney?
Well, once again, you know, Paul was in a position where he believed he had nothing left to lose. When faced with the option of getting even temporary freedom from a future of seemingly endless days in prison, running was the obvious choice. This time he didn't even have to try.
Right. After he escaped, he was determined not to go back to jail. So he needed to get out of Dodge. And fun fact, Wikipedia says an allusion to Dodge City, Kansas, a busy cattle town of the late 19th century, notorious for gunfighters, gambling, brothels, and saloon. I wondered what that, like get out of Dodge.
Get out of Dodge.
Yeah, it's a town in Kansas, apparently. So anyways, he needed a car and he needed money. So he went to the neighborhood of his mother's where he knew who lived in what houses. And he had in mind a house where an elderly occupant lived. He figured she was a snowbirder, so he figured she was out of town. But anyways, his plan was to rob the place, steal a car, and be on his way. He was in a rush, so he actually broke into the window to get inside instead of picking a lock. And he thought she was away, like I said. But unfortunately for Alice Curtis, she was at home. She came downstairs to investigate the noise and came face to face with Paul. She was 65 years old, and it was easy for him to grab and tie her up. He assured her he wouldn't hurt her. He just needed some things, and then he would be on his way. She told him where her car keys were. And at some point, to be sure she didn't scream, he stuck a rag in her mouth. He then went through the house looking for items to sell, money, clothing, etc. When he finished with this, he went back to Alice to let her know he was leaving and she'd be okay. But it was too late. So she was hunched over in a chair unconscious and she had bile dripping out of her mouth. And Paul tried to, you know, help her, like, rouse her, and it just didn't work. So when he removed the gag, vomit, like, just started spewing out of her mouth. So what had happened was she died. She passed away because her dentures were forced out of place by the gag that he shoved in her mouth. And then she began to vomit, and then she choked and died on the vomit. And that is just an awful way to go, Courtney.
You know, Alice's death, I think, is another important turning point in Paul's life. He did not intend to kill her, but he recognized that he was responsible for her death. And while he had killed before, this time he was not in a rage-fueled state. He believed that he was in control of the situation. And so Alice dying was something that he had not anticipated. And he likely felt panicked and then started acting in irrational ways as a result of that panic.
Yeah, I can only imagine, because I'm not a killer. But yeah, he didn't mean for this to happen. He was going to let her go. And, you know, he didn't even, I don't think he would have even hit this house had he known someone was home.
Right.
That's not like his style at this point. But, well, at first, probably because he had untied her when he tried to rouse her, the police treated it like an accidental death. But as the cause of death was officially announced, they started to suspect foul play. So unfortunately, by then, the crime scene had been so overrun by first responders and everyone else who went through the house that there really wasn't any forensic evidence. They surmised that it was a burglary gone wrong, which it actually was, if you think about it. So in his mom's neighborhood and adjoining neighborhoods, there are these two little girls named Lillian and Milette. And on the day that Paul murdered Alice, they were playing in the neighborhood by Alice's house, which is a little farther from their neighborhood, their direct neighborhood. But Paul recognized them. They knew Paul because he had, you know, been in and out of his mom's house for years, right? So anyhow, he would have just left town after what he had done, you know, not really planning much more than that, but, you know, he was changing. So he knew those little girls and they knew him, and he was not technically a stranger, and he was very paranoid that they saw him. So when he drove up to them and offered them a ride back to their house, they readily accepted, especially when he told them their parents were worried about them and needed to return home right away. So they get into his car. They didn't notice that they were headed in the opposite direction of their house. He kept them calm and told them that their parents had gone out to the boonies and he was supposed to deliver them there. Paul drove them to an isolated swamp. They're in Florida, remember? So when Lillian asked why they had stopped there, Paul got out of the car, opened her door, and strangled her while her little sister watched. Apparently, Milette tried to pull Paul off her sister, but she was just too small and he was too big, and there was no one around who could hear either of their screams. So after Lillian died, he shifted his attention to Milette, and she managed to get out of the car and ran as fast as she could, but her little legs didn't take her very far. Paul grabbed her and brutally strangled her on the ground, and he claims that he lifted her whole little body off the ground with his hand around her neck when she finally succumbed and died. Paul threw both of the little bodies into the swamp, and then he headed out of town. So, Courtney, he's really escalated. I mean, did it in his mind to save his ass, but still, this seems pretty damn brutal.
I think that Paul was kind of acting out like a scared animal that is cornered. You know, he was in a heightened state of fight or flight about accidentally killing Alice. And in his mind at that time, going back to prison was the worst thing that could happen to him. And being antisocial and therefore a little selfish by nature, he was only considering his own feelings and needs. Fearing that Lillian and Milette had the power to send him back to prison, as irrational even as that thought was, even if they saw him, they wouldn't have known what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Paul likely felt that killing them was his only option. And yes, it was brutal and tragic and unnecessary.
I mean, and his adrenaline was probably going so high when he saw them that aided in his irrational decision making.
Absolutely.
From killing, accidentally mm-hmm. killing Alice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. And we know that when, you know, emotions, especially those fight or flight emotions, get really high, like our ability to think and make rational decisions pretty much disappears.
Does this indicate like that he's a disorganized killer?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think what we see from him is sort of like a mixture. Like some of his crimes are very organized mm-hmm. and thoughtful, and others are very spontaneous.
Yeah. Well, Paul next headed to a town called Atlantic Beach. His escape from prison did make the news, but didn't get nearly as much attention as the two missing girls. So obviously they didn't connect those. But why would they? I mean, he was a petty burglarer.
Right.
Or whatever. And these were like a kidnapping or, you know, when they didn't come home, as, you know, homicides.
But right.
Paul was deciding that burglary was just too risky a move. If he got caught again, they may link him to any of the three heinous crimes he had committed. So by now, so he says he killed the three in San Francisco. Unsure on that, but these other three he did do.
Yes.
So 3 to 6 murders he has done. And he had a new plan. He started to hang out at upscale restaurants and bars. He wasn't drinking much. You know, he wanted to be sharp. But he was learning he needed... He was learning he needed to be sharp if he was going to be on the run. Marjorie Howie was a 49-year-old woman out one night who met Paul. He told her he was passing through town and staying at a hotel across the town. She was smitten. Here he was, a young, attractive man hitting on her. She, you know, he's in his early 20s. She's almost 50. Technically, old enough to be his mom. She offered him to come. She offered for him to come back to her house. And that is exactly what Paul was hoping to hear. As soon as they were outside of the bar, Paul started to kiss her and grab her, you know, super passionately. He may even have picked her up and carried her part of the way to her house that was nearby. And Marjorie had been drinking a bit, and this attention probably threw her off guard, but she went along with it. So he was successfully seducing her. When they got to her home, they began, you know, the act of consummating or having consenting sex at first. When he took off her nylons, he then put them around her neck and he looped them around and he began to squeeze. And after he had finished this homicidal act, he robbed her of her upper class possessions and took off. Courtney, a couple things. So now murder seems to be his new way of dealing with problems. And second, his motivation seems to be money, which is a little different from the sexually motivated killers we've seen in the past. Do you have any new diagnosis?
So Paul had learned from his past experiences that he needed to leave no witnesses if he had any hope of staying out of prison. And he had also discovered that he was capable of murder and that it was a potential outlet for his pent-up rage. We have talked before about how serial killers experience this rush of dopamine, kind of like taking a hit of drugs the first time that they kill. And then they spend the rest of their lives searching for that feeling again. And after each time they kill, it gets a little bit easier and easier to do it each time. So Paul is now at that point in his development as a serial killer where he's got a taste for it. And now he's it's starting to get easier for him to do. So I don't really have any new diagnoses for Paul. I still believe that he likely had complex PTSD and antisocial personality disorder.
Well, Marjorie's body was discovered several days later by her estranged husband. It was really sad. So, of course, her husband was the prime suspect for many months. When he was cleared, though, he was already pretty much ruined, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Paul was driving around, seemingly bored, when he picked up a female hitchhiker. He got angry with her because she didn't respond to his flirtations. Poor Paul and his ego. He thought she should know there is no such thing as a free ride, and he was giving her a ride. So, you know, she owed him something. He pulled off the main road, and she complained about this, and the complaining escalated his already foul mood. They started to argue, and apparently he just started to yell at her with, you know, rage. And then he started to hit her, and then he kept hitting her. And then he pulled her out of the car by her hair and tore off her clothes as she struggled with him and then got on top of her and raped her. He enjoyed it. He then proceeded to strangle her while he was still raping her, and she'd passed away. And there you have it, Courtney. Again, his motivations for committing murder have changed from accident to covering his tracks to needing money to now pleasure.
His transformation from petty criminal to serial killer is now complete.
It's just so weird how you can, like, watch it in a way. I mean, well, according to the book, quote, this was where his path had led him, to a place where he could kill when he pleased. And now, for the first time, he realized that it pleased him greatly. Killing felt good. Owning her felt good. Being the biggest and the strongest and the best, it all felt amazing. He felt like a god as the body still wrapped around him began to cool. End quote. Courtney, I don't know what it is about strangling, but women who are in domestic violent relationships, when the man strangles a woman, it's extremely dangerous. And that type of DV oftentimes leads to death.
Yes. You know, strangulation itself is a very personal and intimate act. The killer has to be very close to their victim, can often make and hold eye contact while they're strangling them, and can literally feel the life leaving the body. It's sort of the ultimate feeling of power and having possession over another person. And ultimately, domestic and intimate partner violence is all about power and control.
Well, that's where we're going to stop for the day. Do you have any last thoughts, Courtney?
I'd say, you know, from here, Paul's story really speeds up and escalates. So next week's episode should be a wild ride. And I also just kind of want to point out, so that one murder that he did Marjorie, right? That is where the name Casanova Killer comes from.
Okay.
He was seducing older women, taking them back to their homes and then robbing and killing them.
Yeah.
But really, he didn't do it very much.
Right. I noticed that when I was reading. I mean, there was a couple like that.
Right.
But more so kind of more like the impulsive right there. None of that seduction shit first.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's where the name comes from.
Yeah. And I mean, the other name was, what was it? The
road trip killer.
Like the run around the country killer.
Road trip killer.
But the Casanova killer just has a more of a twang to it.
It does. It sounds...
Did they give him that moniker? Never mind. I don't want to give anything away. All right. Well, that's where we're going to stop for this week.
Yes.
Next week will be the last episode for this one.
Yes.
So it'll be finished. All right.
It will.
Have a good week. Be safe. And we'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye. Bye.